Welcome to Words First, talking text in opera. We have a great show for you today, and it starts with a conversation I had with baritone Zachary Nelson in December. Zach brought me a piece of recitative from Mozart and De Ponte's Le Nozze di Figaro, and we talked about how much he loves De Ponte's words, both from a textual point of view and a contextual point of view. Both of us being history buffs, we talk about the Beaumarchais plays, how they met the cultural moment, and how they live on in opera.
So I chose the final recit of Act 3, right before the actual wedding of Marriage and Figaro. For myself, I think it's the most important moment of the opera. We have a dynamic change, really. And there's what I also love about it is it is also probably one of the most historically important moments in opera, because it's pretty much one of the many rallying cries of the French Revolution, which was brought upon from the Beaumarchais plays into the opera. And the opera and the Beaumarchais plays only happened, I mean, from the official premiere of the Beaumarchais in Paris to the premiere of Le Nozze in Vienna, it was only 2 years. So it was fraught, and it was an incredible time, I'm sure, to be alive back then. And so it's just, for me, it's my favorite moment of the opera, and I could talk about it for hours.
Here Zach goes into a reading of this recit. But I'm going to skip ahead to the end, when drunk Antonio tells Figaro that Cherubino has already confessed to jumping out the window.
And can you imagine, like, you're getting married, and there's, like, this one, like, annoying, like, uncle, not even uncle, like, a third cousin that's just constantly being like, no, hey, what about this, like, thing that happened 6 years ago? Right. And you're like, it was, who cares? It was 6 years ago.
Exactly.
Where in this opera, it was maybe 6 hours ago, but still, but, you know, here or there. And he's like, Antonio's like, yeah, what did she say? And Figaro's like, que te encanta. Like, what is he talking about? Who cares? And, you know, what is he singing about? And then the count, again, just, I just love all this text. Non canta, no. Me dice che li salto samana in sui garofani. Right? He's saying that he jumped in the garden. Right? And then this is the most beautiful moment. It's like the it's gorgeous. It's like a sweet pastry. He goes, e lo dice, Sara, se ho saltato io, si può dare che anch'esso abbia fatto lo stesso. Anch'esso, perché no? Pugno mai quel che non so. And then, like, that is, like, what just brings all the barriers down for the Count. The Count is neutered in front of everyone, because what he said is, he says he jumped. Oh, okay. That doesn't mean I didn't jump. And the Count's like, what? Also he's like, yes. And then this is the French Revolution right here. Perché no? Why not? I never dispute what I do not know. And it's gorgeous. It's just like the most gorgeous justice that has ever happened in the history of opera. Yeah. And then we get the march, and then we start with the wedding.
And then we're there.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, I think, you know, it's such an interesting thing, and I the way that De Ponte uses humor in what is truly a serious subject. I mean, at its heart, this is such a serious subject of thinking about how quick-witted Figaro has to be in order to do just the most basic thing of marrying a person that he loves. And I feel like, you know, first of all, for you know, modern day cultural relevance, it's huge. But second of all, just even thinking about the cultural moment at that time and what was happening, that I love, like, going through those words and seeing how how much humor he instills into a moment that really, for so many people at that time, was quite scary.
Absolutely. And if you read about, like, the history of the premiere, right? Mm-hmm. So the Beaumarchais is a lot more counterculture. It's a lot more revolutionary, and it's not really a I mean, there's a comedic moments, but it's not really a comedy. Right. It's more of a drama, where you have this character in Figaro and the Beaumarchais, where he is like insulting the Count to his yeah. face. You yeah. know, they're making it almost a farce, you know, and that is what was so revolutionary about it. Whereas in the opera, they make it kind of, it is more of a buffo. It is more of a comedy, right? But the incredible thing, I was just reading this the other day, when during its first run in Vienna, they decided that they were going to keep all the musical numbers, right? Mm-hmm. But what they did instead was, of the recits, they took those sections mm-hmm. from the play and put those in oh, instead wow. of the recits. So, like, for example, Marcellina has this massive monologue mm-hmm. in the fourth act, and it's considered to be like one of the great feminist moments of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And it got banned in Paris because they said no woman could have the depth of acting to of pull this off. Right, of course. So what happened was is that, like, that caused this massive stir. I mean, mm-hmm. it became, like, I can imagine for the French, in some smaller way, mm-hmm. this play and then this opera became like how Va Pensiero became for the Italians right. when Verdi wrote it.
Right. We forget how huge, and we look at so many of these operas as just sort of these old gems, and we forget how politically huge so many of them were.
Right.
Because we don't see them as pertaining to politics in our own life, and it's sort of amazing when you really do the deep dive, right? That you see right. how daring some of this stuff was in terms of, you know, walking into a court and saying, you know, this is what we're gonna.
Like, right.
Here's the I mean, story it just I shows. Tell.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it just shows the nature of, like, how cyclical everything can be. Totally. You know, it's also amazing that to think now in where we are in society when it comes to entertainment, that opera and plays could have such an impact on the culture. Mm. Whereas, like, I want to think that we still have that now, but it there's no way it was like what it was back then.
Right.
Like, that, you know, this was popular music for them.
Totally.
So, and this was, you know,
this was TikTok.
This play was, yeah, exactly. this was Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, all, like, yes. put in together,
exactly.
all put together. It's amazing. And it's amazing just what I love about Mozart, besides it's countless, but especially with Mozart and the Ponte operas, is that you get a blank canvas with yeah. Mozart, yeah. yet already there are so many colors there. But yeah. it's there's still room to do what you want within it. And there's, like, something beautiful about the restrictions that aren't in there,
yeah.
yet you are guided in some way. Uh-huh. It's just anytime I get to perform a Mozart opera, I feel like I'm being given a gift mm-hmm. because it's just, you feel free. You feel free. I don't know if you feel the same way.
No, I do. I do. And I just, I mean, you know, especially the Mozart da Ponte duo, that I just feel like Mozart was in such reverence to da Ponte's ability to use language that, I mean, you can see their symbiosis just on the page, you know, and I find that right. so delicious. Tell me about your, just briefly here, your relationship to recit, because it's interesting that you brought a recit in terms of, like, you know, and maybe is that where you connect to the text more in recit than you do when you're singing an aria or a duet?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely connect with recits more than, I mean, the music, at least in Mozart, I mean, that's a whole other, like, world, you know, mm-hmm. like, you listen to the act two finale, especially, you know, with that, when it's just the four of them and you have the margarita and you have that big chord underneath, yep. you're like, oh my gosh, right? But what I love about recits is it's what drives the plot. In my opinion,
yeah.
it's how the story moves, right? Yeah. Like, I was working with Leon Major, the first time I studied Figaro, and he made a good point. He's like, recits are where the story moves, and the aria is where you comment on what just happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found that to be so beautiful, and I try to bring that every time I do recits. And the cool thing about recits is arias, you have a real structure. You have a tempo, you have a key structure, you have everything is like right there, and there's not much wiggle room. But for recits, you can take your time. You can speed up. You can really be free to just deliver text.
Yeah.
And I think that's so cool. And I think that's really where we can see these Mozart operas being done in all these other places. Like that that Don Giovanni they did in Salzburg a long time ago. And I remember watching it, and Erwin Schrott was doing Leporello. And it blew my mind. It kind of blew the doors off my brain, really, because he's like stuttering through the recit. And, you know, they're taking these incredibly long pauses. And I'm like, what is happening here? What's going on? At first I was disturbed, but then I realized it was bringing me into the action. It was bringing me into the drama. And that's what the recits did.
It's as close to a play as it's as close to a play as you can get in opera. I mean, it's really where theater and opera take this little woven moment together. It's really fascinating.
From Zachary Nelson, I move over to another history buff and word lover, Carrie K.F. Jacques Laurent. An operatically trained bass baritone, Carrie Laurent was at the beginning of an operatic career when he started writing hip-hop tracks. Now known as Chicago hip-hop artist K.F. Jacques, he makes work that blurs the line between hip-hop and opera. His most recent works are with George Cedarquist and Chicago Fringe Opera, where he composed and starred in the Rosina Project, based on another telling of the Beaumarchais Figaro plays, Rossini and Sterbini's The Barber of Seville, as well as writing words and music for Corsair for the Decameron Opera Project, which has come up numerous times on this podcast. Here's my deep dive with Carrie K.F. Jacques Laurent on writing words for hip-hopera and the deliciousness of blending musical genre.
Carrie, welcome to Words First. I am so happy to be speaking with you today after ages of not talking.
Me too. Thank you, Katora.
Yeah, you're a trained opera singer. And in fact, this is how you and I met. We performed together back when I was still appearing on stage, and you were still pursuing a degree, I think, at that time. And we did Death in Venice together at Chicago Opera Theater. So tell me, did you start with classical music, or were your first musical influences in hip-hop, or did they sort of come together at the same time, or someplace completely different? Did you start with, you know, bluegrass or something? Where were your early influences?
Okay. Yeah, no bluegrass at all.
Shocking.
My experience was, I would have to say, rooted in hip-hop because it was first. And then I started formal education with classical music in junior high school, mm-hmm. with Merit Music in Chicago. I mm-hmm. do weekends and a music program. And then eventually I went to Chicago Academy for the Arts and studied voice and opera. So I was also taking outside lessons in voice. So I was really getting acquainted with the classical style, and eventually got my master's in opera from Roosevelt University here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel like I had somehow made up for my formative years as a hip hop enthusiast.
But did it stick around, or did you divorce yourself from it for a while when you were in classical music studies, or did it?
I did.
Really?
Yeah, I definitely. I feel like there were probably about 5 years that I really focused on classical and opera. Because I saw it as a career move, as a career mm-hmm. choice, and I wanted to invest in my career. So I did really move away from it. But I was drawn back in by all the technical aspects of... When I was doing opera, we were at the cusp of this computer music age, you know? So the idea of having a laptop with recording capabilities was like brand new. And so being able to travel, like I was traveling for opera, but I was like sucked into this world of going back to a hotel and having a laptop and just like, you know, making beats on my laptop and stuff like that. So I had started doing that for many years before KF Jacques became a thing.
Right, basically. Right. And so now, do you consider yourself an opera singer? Do you consider yourself a hip hop artist? Do those sit together in what in how you define yourself, or do you just kind of do what feels right in the moment?
Yes to all of that.
Okay.
I do what feels right in the moment. I didn't always have that luxury, Katura. Like the thing that the brick walls are sort of the not brick walls, but the challenges that I had navigating my career were mostly based around, am I appearing as KF Jacques, the hip hop opera artist,
mm-hmm.
or am I appearing as Carré Laurent, the opera singer?
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't composed much opera. I was only composing hip hop at the time. And really up until 3 years ago, was I approached with the idea of doing the Rosina Project,
right.
with Chicago Fringe Opera and Pivot Arts, and we made sort of this independent organization where we did a hip hop Barber Seville. So it afforded me the opportunity to do the opera singing and composing, and also the hip hop and tracks and stuff like that. So it gave me an opportunity to really legitimize, solidify the whole, the genre of hip opera, basically.
Do you feel like hip hop and opera mix well?
I hadn't always felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, especially when I was doing opera, and like I said, I was making beats in hotels and stuff like that, I kept those things far apart.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I experimented, like I was always, trying new things, but they would never saw the light of day.
I think every artist has a whole pile of those.
Oh my goodness. There's a lot of them. And I had like mini discs. I don't know if you remember mini discs.
I do. Oh my gosh.
It was like, oh, I can record digitally and skip to the track that I want to, blah, 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 blah. So I still got boxes of mini discs in the studio.
God.
With stuff that nobody's heard, but it was bad. It was terrible, Katura. Like what I was making was like, I would make a legitimate hip hop beat and then I would sing legitimate opera and I felt like they just didn't mesh well.
Uh-huh.
Later in my career, I figured out why that was. And we can hit on that when we talk about the Rosina Project, but a lot of things evolved in that scenario.
When, who would you, this is my last question before we actually dive into your projects, but who would you consider sort of influential? Do you feel like you're out there alone sort of braving this path, or do you have influences that have helped you with this sort of crossover stuff that you're working on?
I take from everyone. Like there's no, I don't think there's any hip hop artist that I've been, inspired to emulate.
Uh-huh. Got it.
So the reason I pause is because I don't think they're bad. I just think that I think that it's branched off into so many directions. The hip hop, like you say that to somebody and it can be so many different things.
Yeah.
It can be a guy singing in his car with, he could be singing, you know, original text in opera over, you know, a hip hop beat that's famous as well.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. We've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen an iteration where it's mostly gospel and live instruments,
huh.
and some rap involved, which is dope. I love it.
Yeah, cool.
But it's not the same.
Yeah.
Then you've got Hamilton, where you know it's rap, but it's a lot of musical theater, and it's a lot, and the instrumentation is very musical theater. It's not very hip hop, except they did the remix and they made it more hip hop. But.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's that iteration, right?
Sure.
What I'm doing is I want to be where Hamilton made the hip hop beats for the remix. I want my hip hop to be authentic from the jump, from the get go. So
okay.
My beats are really heavy hip hop. Like, I have not, this was part of my approach for K of Jacques, was I haven't tried to mold the hip hop portion in a fashion that will be inclusive for people that only like opera or something like that. And likewise with the opera, I don't sham the opera side of it because I want hip hop lovers to love the opera part too.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
When people come up to me and go, "Oh yeah, that was good, but you should really take that opera part out." Like, I know I've done my job, right? And like, when people come up to me and they're like, "Oh, your opera voice is beautiful. You should really pursue that more. You should really go in that direction." Like, okay. So I know, you know, I know I'm right where I'm supposed to be because, it is some, I feel like art has to rub people the wrong way. It has to be abrasive in some sort of way so that they remember where they heard it from. Cause no one will ever tell me that, you know, "Oh, I don't remember him," or, you know, "He's just like so-and-so." Cause the second, I mean, when I was younger, I used to do that. I used to try to make beats like so-and-so or sing opera like Ren Turkel, you know, right, or make beats like Timbaland. And as soon as you do that, people are like, "Yeah, it's good, but there's nothing there. You know, there's no there there."
Right.
When something rubs them the wrong way, I feel like, okay, you'll remember me from now on.
Yeah, I love that so much. I think there's something, you're right, this idea of being a little bit abrasive, like not being mm-hmm. total sandpaper, but just enough that exactly. Somebody, you know, it's like a cat's tongue versus a dog's tongue, right? You want to just be a little yeah. bit rough. So yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Rosina Project. So
yeah.
you did this, was this last year the first time that it happened, or had you been working on it for a while?
We had been working on it. We actually were part of a workshop for a non-for-profit organization called Pivot Arts, uh-huh. and they are an arts incubator for all different types of disciplines, dance, movement, visual, dance and movement, visual, theater, and music. So they, we were accepted under, we were accepted and also given a grant to do this incubator program with Pivot Arts. Mm-hmm. So they were the first impetus. They got some groups into like the Goodman Theater and stuff like that. Like, so they've really been good to the arts community, and they really are a wonderful jumping off point for launching not just a career, but like a show, you know,
cool.
or a performance or an experience, should mm-hmm. I say. So that's where it all started in the spring of 2018, I believe. Maybe it was 2019.
Okay.
2018. And then, so we've been working it since that whole time. I got to tell the story of how I got
Please.
Involved in this thing.
Yes.
There is a director that I love. I love this guy. His name is James Marvel. I don't know if you've ever come across
yeah,
him.
Yeah, we live in the same town. I'm in Knoxville, Tennessee. So he's here at the university. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That's my dude. So so I kept running into this guy. I met him the first time at Utah Festival Opera in the Young Artist Program there. And then I worked with him in Sarasota. I worked with him in Cedar Rapids. I drove him to Chicago with me one weekend to hang out with my parents. I mean, that's how, you know, it's like I saw, we don't, you know how it is in the opera world. Like, you see people, you have these wonderful connections with them, but you don't know when the next time is you'll see them. You may never see them again. And it was just like that with James. And all of a sudden, I get this email from George Cedarquist. He's the director of Chicago Fringe Opera here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Yeah, I got your number from James Marvel. I've been thinking about doing a hip-hop Barber of Seville." I just started cracking up because you can't imagine the times we were in rehearsal for like Barber Seville or I loved James would do a lot of Verdi and stuff like that. Like I'd be like beatboxing and stuff in the rehearsal.
Yeah.
So the fact that, you know, my name popped up for him and he, you know, he made that connection. It's like, you know, you never know, you know, where your passion leads you and why it leads you there. And if it's really your passion, people know that about you. It's a part of your character, a part of who you are.
So what was your, did you only write the music or did you do some of the libretto? I know you performed in it, some of it, because I saw some video. But what was your ultimate role in putting this together?
So I really wanted to have a hand in the music, a heavier hand in the music. I think I was traveling that summer, and so I wasn't able to be to necessarily participate as fully as I wanted to. So I accepted to do the music and the tracks, and I even had a Chicago beatmaker, a student from Northwestern University, who was helping me out, and I actually had him do some complete tracks of his own. A few of them are just his. His name is Ketchy. And he's really, really good, really dope artist. Neo soul guy, has a voice of velvet, but he produced these tracks. So we've used those tracks. They're bangers too. They're fantastic tracks. I really wanted that authentic hip hop sound. I really didn't want to do something that was watered down or musical theater. I just wanted to make sure this was hip hop. And I wanted to make sure we told a story of Rosina. And we, brought on a Chicago hip hop artist by the name of Pinky Ring, and she plays the part of Rosina.
Okay.
So we've decided to tell the Barbers of Seville from the standpoint of Rosina. So I did mostly tracks on that. Words were second on the Rosina project.
Right.
But the guy that we had, his name is Mike Parrish. He did most of the lyrics. I rewrote the lyrics for, the Largo Al Factotum, what would be the equivalent of that, when I came on a year later in the role of Figaro.
So when I saw the video of you doing Largo, that was yours.
That's my, so that's my adaptation of the original libretto for the Barber of Seville, for Largo in the Barber of Seville.
It was fun. That was fun to watch. Yeah, it was great. You had those dancers behind you. It was very cool.
Oh, yeah. That was a good time. There's more to come, too. We're working on the mixtape, and we're going to drop that soon.
Good. What was it like to take an existing operatic work and adapt it for a totally different genre like that?
It was just something that I always wanted to do. I can't express how gratifying it is just to be at the moment now where I can talk about it in retrospect, because when you think about it, it's both daunting and terrifying. And there, us artists, you know, we have a lot of voices in our heads about, you know, whether it's people from the past or people from, you know, I've had people tell me, oh man, that opera's good, but don't do that rap, man. I want you going down. And these are like, you know, grown ass men, you know, don't do that rap, man. I want to hear you do that rap. Everybody doing rap. Like, okay, fine. Everybody and their mother can rap, right? So great. That's not true, but it was something where, you know, I felt the challenge of all these people and influences and, you know, ancestors and, you know, people in the future as well, you know, predecessors. Yeah. You feel like I got to capture this moment right here and make sure that it's something quality. So that was the first sort of feeling, was this overwhelming moment, this overwhelming feeling of being in the moment. And after capturing all that ether and putting it all into a little ball, I felt like the best approach would be to consider the context of the opera and the timing and why it was written, why, you know, librettist and Rossini and, you know, all the players felt it important to put this on at the time. So that's how I approached it. And I tried to draw those parallels with what was going on today, with inequality, with gender relations, all these things. And we were headlong into the Me Too movement.
And it's amazing how relevant all of that still is from that. You look at those pieces like that and
you know,
oh my gosh, we are still talking about this.
They talk about history repeating itself. It's like, it's unreal. And so you think, yeah, you people might listen to it and go, now that's a genius correlation. Like, no, it writes itself, you know?
Exactly. Wow.
It just happens like that. So, yeah, absolutely.
So you said that.
So that's how I approach it.
You're writing, you're doing, you said there's a more of this coming out. You have more happening. What are your hopes for this piece, or what are your thoughts about it moving forward?
So as far as the Rosina project is concerned, we would like to do a film version of it. Clearly, because of the pandemic, a lot of people are turning to film, and I got my feet wet with the operatic film with Corsair. Mm-hmm. So that's... We were, of course, in 2020, all of the live performance organizations had to figure out a way to present their art.
Yeah.
So everyone has gone the film route. They've been going crazy. Like, I'm seeing, like, Seattle Opera with Don Giovanni. I'm seeing, you know, people in Houston and Fort Worth and, like, all across the world.
Yeah.
All around the world, you see, no, across the world, it's a flat earth. You see, the whole time you've been seeing these people that adapted these operas for film. And I'm so excited because I've been telling people that are involved with the Cameron and Corsair that, it's like, you know, there was a time where I separated and distanced myself from the classical world so I could do KM shots. And it feels like it has sort of followed me over because I've done the music videos and the film and and trying to sync everything with the music and having the studio at home, which is something that a lot of classical musicians are facing right now.
Yeah.
Heck, everyone's facing it because, you know, people are doing broadcasts, like podcasts, et cetera. So
it feels like you were sort of like primed to meet the moment, even though you didn't realize that's what was happening. It's almost
not
like,
at all. I didn't realize it. And they say that, you know, it's always about preparation meets opportunity. And wow, I was blindsided.
There you were, just, you know, sitting around, comes and smacks you in the face. It's pretty nice.
Yep. Absolutely.
So
beautiful.
So you mentioned Corsair. I want to talk about Corsair.
Yes.
Was Corsair the first original crossover piece that you've done, like not adaptation like Rosina Project, or have you done other hip-hop opera crossovers?
So I've done albums under the artist name of KF Jacques, and that's the closest I've gotten.
Okay.
This is the first organized work that I've done that's a part of any operatic piece. So,
got it.
Besides Rosina Project, which is sort of a thing on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, we're trying to add more operatic vocals into Rosina Project currently, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. we're still tweaking it. You know, it's still growing, still an organism.
Yeah.
So as far as Corsair goes, I really got to hit the nail on the head. It's a true indicator of where I was last year,
uh-huh.
at the time that I wrote it, last spring. So it's a good culmination of everything. It really does have all of my pop vocals, my opera, my rap, and all the beats are entirely mine. So that's really
great.
A big deal for me. So
yeah.
I feel like, you know, I got to hit everything. And like, it's not just opera and hip hop. You'll hear gospel influences. Yeah. You'll hear some alternatives, some punk sounds in there. So I'm all about it. I'm
really
you. Excited.
It's musical you,
it's
in a little microcosm.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And so I've done that for KF Jacques for singles and albums. Uh-huh. And most of my albums are not, no, all of my albums are collections of songs that are, were put together over a period of time and curated,
mm-hmm.
whereas Corsair was written for Corsair. The only thing that had already been written was the opening piece in Corsair before they had approached me about it.
Okay.
But there's a story for that, too.
I don't know
how deep you want me to go into everything.
Tell me.
But the opening song... it's called Your Love Provides, and I don't know if you remember, but it's I've never seen in all my days such blustery rains which blow three ways. for some reason I wrote this song, and I tend to have creative like collections or flows. So this is part of three songs that I wrote, and it had all these. I just want to find it real quick.
Yeah.
I didn't, it has all these references to the sea and seafaring, and Corsair is about this merchant who goes out to sea. Mm-hmm. And when I was approached with the project, it was like, I don't know where this came from. You know what I mean? Like, I wrote all the lyrics for this theme, and lyrics had been written. Such blustery winds, which blow three ways, that carries lies. And, I wish I could find this thing really fast. But, yeah. I just want to go through this because it really did. I'm just going to read it real quick. Your love provides as the day is long. Despite my faith, which took the blow, despite the heart on my sleeve, which show, despite mere men to take me down, my words were lost, but now profound. So, of course, there's a little Amazing Grace in there, but... Yep. I feel like I was sort of ruminating on where my career was. It's so funny when it's quiet and, you know, you don't know, like, especially career-wise, yeah. You're like, what's going on in the universe, you know? Sometimes you're like, am I supposed to be doing something or am I supposed to be just chilling, you know, like waiting for just, you know, continue the
it's
course.
Just how much trust you have in yourself in that moment, right? And what the universe
absolutely.
Is doing.
Absolutely. Oh.
It's right? So hard.
It's sometimes excruciating, right? Because you're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do about this or if I'm supposed to be doing anything. Took for a fool in love, a fallen soul from up above. But while I'm here, while I'm alive, I won't be swayed. Your love provides. As the day is long, this song I sing. Your love provides and all it brings. My words were lost and I fell down. Your love provides. I've left the ground. So I did this rap. Oh, your love provides when fools collide. Man down, we're tied. Only thing about the break is my pride. I ain't even got time to be down in the dumps when the bumps hop up in the road. I ain't even got a place to replace all the space that I wasted. My brain's unfroze. Did I say I had lows? When the gigs pile up and accounts look up, in the blink of an eye, you're closed. This was March of 2020.
There you go.
Next thing you know, stuck in the studio, we will rock you beats with pros. Because the beat's like, I said, we will rock you beats with pros. Blocks of writers quarantined and trapped across the globe. I should have said around the globe. No, across the globe. The flat globe. I just might put a lock on the game and watch the block explode. You catch it, it's a wave. Face to face, we've just gone waves. Social distance, just a thing to save us from our souls. So there were all these like wave and wind and all these things. And George Cedarquist was like, this is the Cameron story that I want to do, where he talks about this merchant of the sea. And I'm like, I've got just the thing. And like, so yeah. So we had like a pitch meeting with, you know, with the heads of Chicago Fringe Opera.
Yeah.
And I played that song for them. And they're like, wow, this is like, they got excited, like I was excited, and I was like, yes, like this is what I'm saying, you know? It's one of those things where you just get that, you know, inspiration, and I'm not excited about my music because I think highly of myself. Like, I literally, Keturah, do not know where it comes from. I have dreams, and I wake up with a soundtrack to the dream, and I'll go record it or something like that, or, you know, like these words, like I can't take credit for it. It's just an inspiration. And I'm always excited about that.
I love that you just said that. I just, you know, the last interview that I did was with Ricky Ian Gordon. And that was last week. And he said a very similar thing, that he wakes up with this sort of fever dream thing and it's there and he's just got to put it down on paper before it disappears because it's all there already. I think all of us who are creatives have that to a certain extent, but there are some people, and it sounds like you're one of them, that just really, it's like your brain does its own thing. It's like you're not conscious of it. It just kind of makes its own thing.
Not at all.
And you
it's
put it out
flow.
There. Wow, that's
absolutely
really interesting.
Yeah.
I just want to say, what struck me about Corsair, besides how just gorgeous the video was, like I just think all of you just did this amazing it's just so lush and beautiful and sort of sleek, and this it was so nice, but it was how seamlessly the hip-hop and operatic musical traditions and the gospel and all of that just combined in this really gorgeous way. Do you feel that about it, about that particular piece?
I do. And that is another success that I feel that I had last year, because even with Rosina Project, I ran into a challenge. As I was saying, I'll take you back to when I was talking about trying to combine the two and making a lot of crap, and then, you know, like realizing, okay, there's got to be an approach to this, right?
Yeah, right.
So you pull out the academic and you know, the scientist gets back to work. So I realized that the reason we run into problems with hip hop opera all the time, and every composer can vouch for this, is that hip hop, true hip hop, authentic hip hop, has been mostly in minor keys. So if you think about that, and of course you can go back to like what is the name of hip hop?
Oh my God, what is that called? It's the Paradise.
Say Gangster's Paradise.
It's not, though.
It's not, right?
Yes.
Why are we drawing this blank right now?
I have no idea, but yes.
I'm moving all cred. My stock just went, but
Rapper's Delight.
Rapper's Delight. Thank you. Yes, Katora. So Rapper's Delight, like it's light and airy, but you know, you're still in that minor mode.
Yeah.
And it's like, I figured out that it's mode mixing. So the way to switch back and forth is you have to do the mode mixing, and you use the pivots or maybe your six chords or whatever to switch back and forth into the modes. Or just stay minor. And that's something that I did, in the Rosina Project, because we wanted to have more references to the original opera.
Mm.
And George kept coming back to me. He's like, yeah, I love these beats, but I'm missing those opera references, those Barber of Seville references, the Rossini references. And I told him one day, I was like, George, they're all major. The whole thing is in major, and it's very hard. So Catchy, I'll give him credit as a student. Like, he was very successful at, there's a part where he put the bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. So he had us all grooving. I was like, okay,
yeah.
Catchy did it. So I mean, there's some skill to it, but it's really challenging. So with Corsair, I was able to, first of all, I didn't have to acquiesce to any previously composed work. So
something nice about that.
So you heard me go straight minor on everything. Like, one of the first tracks after that, Your Love Provides, one of the first tailored tracks for Corsair was the So I wanted it to be sort of stark and sort of like create this environment, this acoustic environment, if you will, so people could sort of just feel like they're in this vast expanse. And I told them that I wanted it to be like Dark Knight. You know, they're like, what kind of film are we going to do? Like, I want it to be Dark Knight, you know, in Chicago, you know, like, the old Gotham, you know. So I'm like, we're going Christopher Nolan with this, guys. And I want my, who's the composer that does the Christopher Nolan movies? Hans Zimmer.
Yes, thank you.
So Hans Zimmer does those brass pedal tones. And so that's how I started it, because I was like, I see this coming into fruition. Like, I know what I want to do here. And so that's how I came with "In These Endless Dark." You've never heard Hans Zimmer with the damn opera vocal.
Oh, it's true.
With a male vocal, right?
Yeah.
It's always, you know, the, but you're never going to hear the male opera vocal. So I was so excited. I was so excited to just get something out there that had that unique feel. And then it evolves. It moves into this hip hop beat.
Yep.
with the brass that makes that pedal tone, and it just comes out like fierce. It just becomes this whole other dark sort of Vader type thing.
Yeah, so. Right. I want to talk about words, because this is a podcast about words. So I want to talk about what it was like to write words for Corsair, but I also just want to talk about what it is like to write words for hip hop. That do you, is the rhythm what you start with, or is the content what you start with? How do you even approach something like that?
The answer again is yes.
Great.
For me, I really start with rhythm, mostly. Content dictates what the beat will be or what the feel, what the emotion is behind it. Sometimes I'll write an acapella rhyme, you know, if I'm just feeling myself, you know, just driving in the car, you know, like,
sure.
I'm just like, okay, all right. But that's a mood. That still is dictated by the feel. So I start there, and then and that dictates the rhythm. So the rhythm is what I hear when I'm listening to beats and stuff. You hear me go, I ain't even got a little fun of something. Like, that's me figuring out what the pentameter will be before I actually place the syllables in the words. And then I'll go to the first line, which I want the first line to really define what the journey is going to be for me, whatever the piece is. So I'm coming from nothing. I'm looking for something to keep him from jumping the board. Like, this is the part of the Corsair where he sort of made it to this certain point where he was a pirate and he pillaged and made all this booty. Mm-hmm. And now people are coming for his booty,
right,
figuratively and literally. So he's like, I'm coming from nothing. I'm coming from nothing. I'm looking for something to keep him from coming aboard. So he really wants to keep people off of him, because he's now a target, and he was going after targets for so long that he became a target himself. So that was the first line that I wrote, and then after coming aboard, I figured, okay. So that's when I try to find. I know I'm going to do ba-da-da-ba-da-da-ba-da-da-ba-da-da. So I know. I'm going to do a rhyme with board, you know, or a board.
Right.
So I don't remember what I wrote, but.
No, what I think is interesting here is that in this particular genre, it sounds like the words actually do come second. You put that rhythm, you lay that rhythm out for yourself, and the words. Is the rhythm of ultimate importance? So, you know, you have to search for a different word in order to fit it into the rhythm, or do you alter the rhythm in order to deal with certain words that you're interested in putting in there?
I rarely alter the rhythm. With me, the most alteration is in articles and sort of like leading. So with music, it's leading tone. So there's the little notes that come in between. And then with text, it is the articles, when. So I will often write something a certain way, and I'll see if it rolls off the tongue the right way, and then I'm trying to do it, and then, like, you know, it's like, okay, maybe not. Mm. Maybe I'll just change a few articles, because I definitely know that I want that rhyme to land on that beat.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Uh-huh.
So that's how it works with the rap. When it comes to the singing parts and opera, I think, yeah, it's dealt with the same way. I do the same thing there. You know, obviously there's words that we want emphasized. They might not be rhyming words, but they're the longer, you know, parts of the phrase.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically it. So I make my alterations on the little insignificant articles and connecting words. Like, if, when.
Right, yeah. That makes sense. And so then you can dance around the more important ones and place them where they need to go.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. And you'll never really lose the idea.
Uh-huh.
And they are important. I don't mean to insinuate that they are not important, because sometimes I'll get hung up on an article like, man, it shouldn't say because, I mean, it really is the. So, you know, you really want to pay attention to the meaning first, uh-huh. but definitely when it comes to trimming and stuff like that, that's where I trim from, and just to get everything into the pentameter that I want.
Do you ever find that the words and rhythm come at the same time? I mean, is that, I think if you were talking about sort of just coming up with something in your car, like that would be words and rhythm happening
absolutely.
Together.
Yes. And really, I think it happens in speech all the time. And right. I feel like I'm really good at picking up languages and pronunciation of foreign languages and stuff like that because of my musical background.
I was going to say, thank you, opera training.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. So just this whole rhythmic, this idea of rhythm and pentameter and text, I feel like I have a good grasp on languages, and I hear that stuff all the time, almost in a savant sort of way, it's just like I'm picking up, oh, I was just telling my buddy about this. So there's a song that I go to. Anytime I hear the amount of syllables in this song, it automatically pops into my head. The song pops into my head. And it's not about the words that are actually in the song. It could be any syllables. Anyway, I can't remember right now. Yeah, but of course.
But it's like you remember the refrain. It's like you put it into the song. So your brain does that.
Sledgehammer. So three syllable. I know, and a bit of all the songs. I'm trying to find a three syllable phrase or word.
That's close.
But I every time I get a three syllable word, I hear sledgehammer, and I don't know why.
But I think that people that have that kind of brain, like you do, this sort of rhythmic brain, that you're finding rhythms in speech that you can slide into other rhythmic spaces, and I think that makes perfect sense. It's fascinating, and this is I think also why you write what you do, because your brain
absolutely
just does that.
Does it? Yeah. It just does it automatically. Absolutely. Okay, so your name wouldn't be appropriate because your second syllable is...
it's the second syllable, Keturah. Yeah, that's right.
That also kills me. Like, when I hear people compose things or sing a song with the accent on the wrong... Yeah. I'm like, no. I'm like, you have stressed the wrong syllable in your music, my friend.
Yes. It used to drive me nuts with recitative. Still drives me nuts with recitative. You go through there and it's like, you know, it's like I don't even speak Italian that well, and I know that's right. Not right.
You know that's wrong. You know that's anything but penultimate. Like,
So what?
Absolutely.
What are your plans for writing work in the future? Do you plan on doing more opera crossover work?
Yeah. I want to do a full feature length, and it's funny. I was thinking about this recently, and I was like, oh, like part of me says, oh, I can't like share what I want to do because people like take your ideas, and
I always get nervous about that too. So
it's nerve-wracking. But I'm about to put some gems out here. I'm not gonna tell you everything, but I've been thinking about it a little bit, and all of my ideas come from my entire life, my informed experience. Mm. So I've been reading. I just finished Barack Obama's book that he released in November. Yeah. So amazing. Like everything I wondered about the presidency, he like goes through it, and he gets even over technical about it. And I loved it.
Just
like
the
I was geeking out over.
Yeah.
Oh, it was fantastic, you know? I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed having all my questions answered. You know, people, think prior to 2016, people thought of it as very lofty, goal was to be president. And I feel like now everyone's kind of over that, but it turns out I didn't need to be that qualified
right,
to do that job.
Right.
But just hearing Obama's reverence for the office and hearing what it took for him to get there. And even like he was an atypical story as well. People forget very quickly, you know, but he jet rocketed up there, you know. O'Biden's story is probably the more typical story, or except his is a little more exaggerated as well in the opposite direction. But okay, I'm done geeking out about that. But anyway, so Obama's book was very influential. Another thing that I've come across, I've been working on ancestry for my family's history, my parents.
Yeah, my mom does that. It's very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah, I am so crazy. So this is the thing. This is the connection between Obama and ancestry is I'm just a history nut. Like, the thing that's why it's easy for me to find material to write about, because I'm crazy about historical things. And I'll go down wormholes, so, clearly. I was looking up some of the history of my family, and, you know, in the early 1800s, a lot of my family were just slaves. Like, they were listed as cattle, like one, you know, or property, not necessarily, but cattle, but property indeed. But I came across an article that had black slave owners of the 1830s became a thing, because a lot of black Americans were gaining their freedom from the slave trade, and they would go and purchase their own freedom, but they would go and purchase their family members so that they could live free, quote unquote. But on paper and on census, they were listing their family members as slaves because they wanted them to be outside of, you know, they want to buy them off the plantation, basically.
Right.
So that story is like
that's
I just read that last week.
Yeah, that's insanity, but also makes a certain amount of sense, right? But
yeah, wow. Yeah. So it kind of reminds me of 7 years of slaves, yeah. But they touched on it, but he kind of moved north again. And a lot of these people did move north, but apparently in the 1830s in Louisiana, this was a thing. Like, this was happening a lot. So that was really interesting. So I want to write about that. I want to write about that experience. And I don't know how historically accurate it can be, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of records about it.
Yeah.
But publication that I was reading online was from 1936, so it seemed like, you know, there was some credibility in, you know, with the story being told. I would love to hear a love story, right. You know, based around that idea, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, someone was a slave, they fall in love, they buy their freedom, and then they have to figure out how to get their loved one free as well.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah, and so, you know, I think the big question is that how historically accurate does it need to be? You know, I mean, I think as you write things, like, it's always like, how much do we need to make sure is 100% accurate, and how much is it about putting an emotional stamp on these things that happen?
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. And we have enough education about the slave trade in the United States to know what each scenario must have been like, you know?
Yeah.
At least be educated about what the situations were.
Yeah.
Another thing I've been looking at is Jean-Baptiste Pointe-du-Sable. Like, he was a Haitian that immigrated to the Midwest in the early 1800s, maybe late 1700s. And he is acknowledged as one of the founders of the city of Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, I believe he came from the same era as Lois and Clark. I'm not positive about that. I'd have to look that back up again. But he was a fur trader at the mouth of the Chicago River, basically.
Okay.
And Chicago was founded in 1832, I believe, 33, something like that. And he was around in 1800. I believe he died around 1810. But just to imagine that there was a free black Haitian that came to Chicago and started trading, you know, and, you know, he was trading furs and became extremely successful. I mean, this was his thing, because the Chicago River actually connected Lake Michigan and the Atlantic to the Mississippi River, and which ended up connecting everyone to the Gulf Coast.
Right.
So it was a major trading point and trading post. So I've always been interested in his story. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of documentation about this man, and they know that he came from Hispaniola, which is the island that Haiti and Dominican Republic share. So They're not sure, but with a French name like Jean-Baptiste, you know he came from the French side of the
exactly.
island.
Exactly.
Not the
not a lot side, of Jean-Baptiste so. In the Spanish-speaking
exactly,
world.
On the Spanish side. Exactly. So I'm extremely interested in that.
I love that.
More Haitian stories, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, one of the liberators of Haiti, Toussaint Louverture. Mm-hmm. I know there was an opera mm-hmm. written about that previously. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in exploring more about his life and his relationship with Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
And on a more broader note, I'm interested in mashing up the ideas of sci-fi and religion.
Nice.
Sort of a Dan Brown of operas, if you will.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so
there's
so
a lot there.
You've got plans. You've got this amazing. I can't wait.
Yeah. I'm constantly just working on ideas and putting stuff out there. So
that's great.
So we'll see what catches fire next.
I want to ask you a broader question to sort of close this out. So we talked about what stories you're interested in telling right now. What stories mm-hmm. should opera be telling right now? What do you feel like opera should be? I mean, we're in this incredible period in the United States of opera creation. And I
yeah.
think, it's just in the last 20 years, this has become, mm-hmm. I think, really huge. What are the stories we should be making as a community of performers and creators?
Opera is really good at covering history,
mm-hmm.
and I would like to see it used as a timestamp again. I mean, back maybe in the classical period is the last time. It's the last really prevalent moment where opera was really a timestamp. You know, it was really showing you what life was like at the time. So I know there's a lot of modern operas, but even modern operas are covering historic yeah. figures and, you know, historic history. And her story.
Or sorry. Her story, yes. Depends.
But I feel like we need, like, that Black Lives Matter. We need the, you know, Trump the opera. I'm sorry to say it. I'm sorry to put it out there, but that story needs to be told, you know, from whatever side, whatever angle. I think we need to have that put out there because these things are relevant and important, and people's interest will be piqued in the art form if they see themselves in it. So it's very important that we come up with some more current storyline.
So our stories. We need to be telling our stories. Is yes. what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kari, thank you so much. This has been
thank
such
you,
a
Katura.
Great so conversation. Oh, I'm so glad you could join me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Many thanks to two wonderful baritones, Zachary Nelson and Kari K. of Jacques Laurent, for talking with me. And thanks also to you for listening. I'm Katura Stickan. If you'd like to hear these interviews in their entirety, as well as bonus materials and outtakes, you can become a patron of my podcast by going to patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. That's patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. All of my episodes from every season are also available at wordsfirst.buzzsprout.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Words First is recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. A special thanks to Matthew Doucet and Richard Stickan for their generous support, Early Doucet for a beautiful watercolored logo, Eileen Downey for the Mozart, and Randy Ravioli for the minimal barking. Until next time, take care of each other and keep telling stories.